This just in. The Billings Gazette reports that the state of Montana will not have enough money to cover all the claims of livestock killed by predators. And so we ask, who should pay for the animals that have been eaten by animals?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
It is a fact. We all live in a world of eat or be eaten. Those of us who live in the city can hide from that elemental fact by watching a lot of TV or obsessing on social media. But we can't escape from it. Those of us who live in the Rocky Mountains can't really hide from that fact because theirs is a world of animals eating animals. The animals that eat animals tend to belong to the wild, which is to say, they do not answer to the rules and regulations established by people who live in the area. The animals being eaten by other animals tend to be those who have been domesticated by farmers and ranchers, and they do have to follow the rules. They have no choice. Herein lies the conflict that makes life in the Rockies very interesting. Whereas the animals that eat other animals have been well equipped with the means to kill and eat, those who have been domesticated have no means of protection other than the personal efforts put forth by the farmers and ranchers who own them, and they are often watching TV or obsessing on social media themselves. And so, quite naturally, the wild eat the domesticated. This fact, and it is a fact, leads us to ask, who should pay for the animals that have been eaten by animals? Here to help us hunt for an answer, we have Mark Cook, who is president of Wolves of the Rockies, way up there in Stevensville, Montana. Mark, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me back. This is a great opportunity. I hope you are well, and like I say, thank you.
Yeah, honored to have you aboard. It's been almost, 4 years since we last participated in a conversation on wolves. And when we were talking about wolves, we were talking about whether they should or should not be free to roam the Rockies. And for the most part, they have been kind of free. So give us a quick update. 4 years later, what does it look like?
Oh, my gosh, Mike. We've taken a step backwards. Matter of fact, a huge step backwards. In the last legislative cycle, we have approximately 11, from what I understand from Fish, Wildlife, and Parks in Montana, we have 1,156 wolves. And in the last legislative cycle, they passed a bounty bill. They passed what we call a kill-all wolf bill, which means they can now bait, they can now put out snares to increase the catch. They can use night observation equipment and scopes to hunt wolves at night. It's just a relentless push by two representatives, Senator Bob Brown, and Representative Paul Feeler, who live in the Northwest Montana. And they're just looking to knock that number down to barely above the 150 minimum. So what Montana's looking to do is trying to kill over 1,000 wolves this year.
And right across the Bitterroot Mountains from you, Idaho's doing pretty much the same thing, are they not?
Yeah. It's what we see is what Idaho does today, Montana does tomorrow. But I want you to think about this. A bounty. We will now pay $1,000 to $2,500 to go out and kill a wolf. That's not ethical. That is just wrong.
And it harkens back to another era, does it not?
Oh my gosh, yeah. Didn't we learn then?
Yeah. So, and what about Wyoming? It has its own laws as well, correct?
Yeah, but the thing with Wyoming is they were a bug in the ointment, so to speak, with the delisting of wolves, 10 years ago. And what happened was Wyoming refused to go above approximately 150 wolves. So Wyoming is now currently around 200-300 wolves, and it never gets above that. So Wyoming is not, I don't want to say it's a problem, but the way they're managing wolves is to the least, amount possible on the landscape.
Okay. And, of course, all of this business of wolves and cattlemen and sheep growers and so on, but it's not just wolves, is it? It's not just wolves that are doing the predation upon domesticated animals. It's also bears and also mountain lions and coyotes, too. So there is a lot of wildlife in the wilds of the Rockies.
Right. You're absolutely right, Mike. And here's what we've done, and we've been in on this on the bottom floor. We supported this when Representative Cuff put forward a livestock loss bill originally. This is about 10 years ago. If an animal, originally it was just wolves. Now it's turned out to be grizzly bears and mountain lions. So there is a good subsidy program in place where if your animal, your domestic animal is killed, the market value of that animal at the end of that day is what you would normally, that's how it started out, normally receive. So let's just say the market value was $1,000 for a cow that you lost to a probable or a definite confirmed wolf depredation. So you would get $1,000. Well, what they've done now in the last session is they've made it very lucrative. Now they have a multiplier, and it can go up to 3. So if you lose a cow today or you lose sheep today, the value of the animal at the end of today is multiplied times 3, and that's what you would receive from the Montana Livestock Loss Board.
With that kind of law, it would seem you would have ranchers out there staking down a cow in a pasture. Well, here, Wolfie, nice juicy cow for you.
You're absolutely right. But I'm going to tell you, Mike, there's some good livestock producers out there. There's the Blackfoot Challenge, which works really hard to live with the large carnivores. The Anderson Farm down by ranch down by Livingston. Just by Livingston, near, just outside of Yellowstone.
In the Paradise Valley there?
Yeah, they work really, really hard to live with the grizzly bears coming out of the park and the wolves. Mm-hmm. And they do a damn good job. And we're happy to work with organizations like that want to do the right thing. But you hit the nail on the head. There are individuals out there that just let their animals go and they don't maintain them. And they can't understand why they have a loss when they're not, putting in the work to protect them.
Well, Mark, for the benefit of those people who aren't really certain about the history and the evolution of the wolf reintroduction, let's go back to 1995 and bring them into Yellowstone Park. Why on earth did we do that in the first place?
We did that to accelerate the recovery of wolves in the Northern Rockies. And they also went into the Frank Church area of No Return, the wilderness. But, Mike, I'm going to say something that's probably going to irritate some of the individuals that are pro-wolf. We were opposed to that. We would have liked to seen wolves naturally through migration and the natural corridors that are built into Yellowstone all the way up to Yukon. Allow wolves to come in on their own terms. And I think this would have cut out some of the animosity with the livestock community. It would have allowed the elk and other large game a natural time to reestablish their behavior when a big predator like that is on the ground. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, we were opposed to it. We're happy that it's moving along, but I think we could have done it better.
Well, I often tell a story that I think pretty well illustrates the conflict that that reintroduction made in the Rocky Mountain West long time ago, pretty close to the reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone. I did a radio show, what I call a kitchen table remote, because it was from the kitchen table of a sheep rancher outside of Big Timber, Montana. which is just in the lee of Yellowstone Park. Yep. And the discussion was about the reintroduction of wolves and the impact it was having on his sheep ranch. And he, of course, was very disturbed by the impact of having wolves show up and eating his sheep and trying to figure out how he's going to cope with this new world. And right in the middle of the program, without so much as a knock at the door, a fish and game biologist responsible for the reintroduction walked into the kitchen, and he had a tracking antenna in his hand. And without so much as an introduction to me, he just told the sheep rancher, "She's back," which is to say that the matriarch of the wolf pack up in Yellowstone was down eating sheep because it was much easier to eat sheep than to try to pull down an elk or something like that.
Right, right.
And so that really did define. I asked him. I had him sit down at the table and put on the microphone. I asked the fish and game biologist, "Why are you bringing wolves back into the ecosystem?" And he said quite simply, "Oh, that's easy. City people want them." And if you ever go through Yellowstone Park along the road going through the Lamar Valley, you'll see city people with spotting scopes just waiting to catch sight of a wolf. What is it about wolves that so intrigues us? And you, because you're the president of Wolves of the Rockies.
Oh, sure. That's an interesting question. You know, I'd like to touch on a little bit of what the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks representative said to you. I don't think it's so much city people. I think originally Yellowstone was being overgrazed between the bison and the elk.
Well, that was my first question to him. You know, that was my first question. Are you bringing in the wolves to regulate the ungulates that are eating up all the grass? But he said, no. City people want them. We want to
see. Very interesting.
We want to see the wild. And if you think about, you know, the fix that we city people are in with all of the trappings of our civilization and how everything is so narrowly confined and defined and trapped inside of civilization, you know, that call of the wild is pretty powerful.
Oh, sure it is. You know, you got to keep in mind, though, too, for what it's worth, one of the arguments we'll make quite a bit, and we truly believe this, is, first of all, Yellowstone is a national park. It belongs to all Americans. A lot of the land around Yellowstone, a third of the land in Montana is national parks or national forest. Okay, so it's not under the control of Montana, the state itself. So being a national forest or a national park, why should Montana have total control over what happens on that land?
Well, that's a very good question. We're going to have to take a quick break. But when we pick it up, let's ask that. Why should Montana stock growers have a say over what happens on federal land? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Mark Cook, president of Wolves of the Rockies. And you, do you hear the call of the wilds? Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, this is the Food Chain Radio program, What's Eating What, and what is eating what are the animals of the wild, the carnivores that live in the wild, the wolves, the grizzly bears and black bears and brown bears, the mountain lions, the coyotes. They tend to find domesticated animals to be a tasty alternative to try to run down their own wildlife. So they often get into the pasture and kill and eat, or sometimes they just kill. And so what do we do about this? We have set up depredation programs by which states like Montana actually pay ranchers and farmers for the animals that have been lost to the wildlife. But yet there is that conflict, and one suspects that the depredation programs run out of money, and they have. So what do we do? Who should pay for the animals that are being eaten by other animals? So we're talking about this wonderful interface. Animals, wolves, were reintroduced to Yellowstone Park in 1995. And, of course, they didn't hang around just in Yellowstone Park. They moved out and moved on. I just note that here just recently, a wolf from Oregon migrated all the way into Southern California, was killed by a car. The wolf was OR93, a two-year-old wolf, killed by a car on I-5 in Kern County, California. So they don't just hang around in one place. They have long legs, and they can move great distances. And they moved right out of Yellowstone into the National Forest. So that set up a pretty interesting conflict, did it not, Mark Cook?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, it's a challenge. I don't see it as a conflict. I see it as a challenge. And what our thoughts on livestock is we're not anti-livestock, but we can do this together. We can coexist. We got a compensation program to help livestock producers who lose their animal. But when it comes to national forest, we're a firm believer in if there's going to be cattle grazing in national forest, that's one thing. But wildlife should have a priority on forage and the habitat in national forests. They that's their home. Mm-hmm. Cattle aren't, you know, they're not built for forests to consume the forage that's available in the backcountry. But like I said, the main thing is we can do this if we work together. But in the end, we believe firmly that the wildlife should have the priority on what goes on in the backcountry.
Okay, well, and that sets up the conflict, does it not? And that really is perhaps a concept shared by most city people. We love that the thought of that there still being a place that is wild and free.
Right.
And so I would suspect that's an easy sell to city people. So from Yellowstone Park, the wolves moved out into the surrounding territory. Now, sure. What is their range there in Montana? Are they all over the place, or are they still?
Well, there's prime habitat. Montana is 144,000 square miles. And the northwest, there's a corridor that comes out of Glacier National Park in the northwest of Montana and runs down to Yellowstone. And there is, you know, dispersion, natural dispersion of the animals coming out of the park. Some are heading down towards Colorado. Some are heading to the east into Wyoming's killing fields. And some are heading towards the west, towards Idaho. But, Mike, one thing I think is important that people know is we're hearing about the depredation, whether or not it's on private property or in national forest. But let's dig a little deeper into that. There's approximately 2.6 million cattle in Montana. And as of now, we've lost approximately 49 cattle. So think, I mean, if you do the math, and these individuals are being compensated. Mm-hmm. So I don't exactly understand the big argument. Yeah, I understand the point that, yeah, my animal is dead, but you're being compensated three times the value of that animal. And you're on national forest, which belongs to everybody, and you pay a very, very little annual unit payment for the cattle that you have on that property. If you were to go to private property, it would cost you 10 times as much to graze your animal on there. So I think the national forest is a good deal for the livestock producers, but I think they overreact a little bit when they say that the wild, you know, the critters, the wolves especially, are killing their stock. Mm-hmm. 49 last year, and it averages around 60 animals a year, and they're compensated. So I don't understand the argument.
Well, their argument is they want to have free access to that land, I'm sure. And, you know, those of us who live in the city say, well, they should have that land should be open and free to the wildlife because we want things to be wild and free still. Now, let's talk about how we get together and manage this, what would seem to be an impossible situation, that wild predators like wolves and grizzly bears and mountain lions would feed on domesticated animals would seem to be about as natural as you can possibly be. So how do we, like you say, come together on this? Let's start with government, and I guess it would start with the federal government because they have a program called the Endangered Species Act, correct?
Yes, absolutely. You know, the Endangered Species Act is critical. And we have a saying here in our organization that currently the only thing working in Montana bill-wise is the Endangered Species Act. And what we're seeing is there's an effort by, we'll call them the anti-wolf folks and the anti-grizzly bear, anti-carnivore people, to eviscerate and destroy the bite that the Endangered Species Act has, and it's critical that that not happen. Mm-hmm. So the Fed is currently considering relisting wolves.
Okay.
But
when did the Feds delist the wolf?
Oh gosh, 2011.
Okay.
A good decade ago, at least. And then 2011.
Yeah,
yes.
A good decade ago, at least.
Yep.
And then, with the wolves running free and delisted, the states stepped in and started managing the wolf on their own, correct?
Right.
Okay, right. So Montana has rules, Wyoming has rules, and Idaho has rules.
Right.
And so it
management plans.
Management plans, yeah. And those management plans include hunting.
As
all wildlife is managed through hunting programs, so too is the wolf. Correct?
That's true.
Okay. Now go ahead.
Okay, but you have to remember, you have special interest in the form of the livestock community,
right,
and the Montana outfitters and guides
that make a living on
hunting.
That's exactly where I wanted to go next.
Okay.
Because you have the federal government, you have the state government, but then you have interest groups, one of which is represented by organizations such as Wolves of the Rockies, who represent the interest of the predators. And then you have the other side of non-governmental organizations like the Montana Cattlemen's Association, which represent the interests of the cattle. So how do these two sides of the coin work together, if they do, to maintain a status quo in this situation?
Good question. What I'm seeing in our experience, we've been doing this for over 10 years, what we're seeing is there's a communication, a friendly communication between both camps. But make no mistake, the livestock community rules all the legislation coming out of Helena. And currently we have a governor Greg Gianforte, who has trapped and killed a wolf himself, is a trapper and a very consumptive individual who has, and this is going to go down a rabbit hole a little bit, but bear with me. He's appointed a director for Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and six commissioners, because we have a total of seven. He's appointed six commissioners that are all consumptive, and they don't want wolves and other large carnivores in Montana.
What do you mean by consumptive? What do you mean by consumptive?
Well, people that if they kill wildlife, they're killing wildlife like elk and deer to feed their families, and we understand that, and we're okay with that. But the current makeup of Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks senior management and the commission and the governor is anti-wolf, strong anti-wolf. And what we're seeing is the consequences of that right now. Let me give you a quick example, Mike.
Okay.
A year ago now, for the last 5 years, we had been working in Montana on what we call the wolf stamp. And the wolf stamp was going to provide money to Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, long-term sustainable funding of revenue for the department to help manage wolves and other wildlife. When the hunting community found out we were doing this, and we were 1 month away from implementing this, Governor Gianforte got elected, appointed a director. The senior management at FWP didn't want the wolf stamp to begin with because it gave us a seat at the table, the non-consumptive community, a seat at the table. And the hunting organizations who were scared of that shut it down.
Now, what exactly is a wolf stamp?
A wolf stamp, okay, Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks is run, I would say 70% of their income comes from license revenue, from hunting licenses and fishing licenses. Then they get some funding from the Fed through a couple different mechanisms. But cost about $100 million to run Fish, Wildlife, and Parks every year. So $60 million comes from license revenue. So who is paying the bill here? It's the hunting community. And the hunting community has always said, you know, the non-consumptive person doesn't have any say in this because we are the ones paying the bill. Okay. Well, under the public trust doctrine, wildlife belongs to all Montanans. So what we thought was we'll put our money where our mouth is, and we will develop a mechanism working with the department for over 4 years to get this in place, 1 month away from having it become a reality. It was shut down by the senior management and the governor's office at FWP. They don't want to give us a seat. They don't want us to have any influence in the wildlife in Montana.
Mm-hmm. So you have these the ebb and flow of government controls that seem to go back and forth with the politics of the day. The Federal Endangered Species Act being a good example.
Sure.
You know, you start off with a listing of the wolf as an endangered species, then you delist it. Then you know new politics comes in and they think about listing it, and so you have the states fighting over it as well. But I'd like to take you back to the NGOs and how the give and take between those who want to provide for the wild predators like the wolf and those that do not. And, of course, your organization, Wolves of the Rockies, would be a champion of the predator and those that represent the farm and ranch community, I'm going to assume, who don't want one, don't like the predators preying on their domesticated animals. So how do you contend with each other? I mean, you sit down at the table and you smile at each other, but behind closed doors, it's all Katie bar the door, right?
You know, not necessarily. Not from our position, because we one of the things that works to our disadvantage, and I've seen it a lot, is people will come in, or organizations will come in and discuss this topic with decision makers, whether it be a state or federal level, and they get angry. And it gives the opponent, the opposition, the opportunity to say, well, they're too extreme, they're too, irrational. We operate under the principle of respect and kindness. We'll listen to what you have to say. We can agree to disagree, but the important thing is we communicate and we're talking. So, there may be organizations out there that function that way, but they're not helping the problem. They are actually escalating the problem. We don't function like that. So we're very proud of that. And everybody, I can't say one individual that I can think of that would say, have a truly negative thing to say about our organization, in the sense that we're irrational and we're aggressive. We try to be fair.
And in doing so, you still have to contend, because you still have to fight for your side, and your side represents those predators that often prey upon the domestic animals of farmers and ranchers who are trying to make a living at doing that. And so there will be a conflict for as far as I can see into the future. So wondering how we can come to grips with this conflict, and can the wild coexist with the domesticated? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Mark Cook, who is president of Wolves of the Rockies. And you, right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam, paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. You know, my wife and I had the opportunity to stay with some friends up in the Paradise Valley of Montana, and our host had on his wall a wolf pelt. And what was striking to me about this wolf pelt was that it was 7 feet long from stem to stern, from nose to tail, 7 feet long. And it was just amazing. And of course, our conversation drifted into wolves, into the reintroduction of wolves. And our guest said, if you want to see wolves or perhaps just hear them, just go up into the road up there on the side of the hill about sunset, and you'll hear them for sure and maybe see them. So the wife and I went up on the road and had a evening glass of wine on the hood of the car and just waited as the light faded and it got quiet. And then we heard them yipping at first, and then as they came down the mountain, howling. And it was a magnificent sound. It just sent chills up and down you. We had that opportunity to hear the wolves going out on the hunt. And we could also hear the cattle down on the valley going, oh! And there it was. So can the two live together in the splendor of the Rocky Mountains of American West? Do you think they can, Mark Cook?
Oh, I absolutely think we can. We can do this. I mean, we can put a man on the moon, you know, 50 or 60 years ago. We can certainly live with the wildlife that we're trying to bring back to the landscape. Mm-hmm. There's good templates out there. There's a program called, it's run by a gentleman named Seth Wilson, Dr. Seth Wilson, and Jim Stone from the Rolling Stone Ranch in Orlando, which is right on the cusp of the Bob Marshall Wilderness. The Blackfoot Challenge is a very, very proven template that we can live with these animals.
Well, how does it work?
It works with a bunch of things. Some of the good things are the neighbors talk, and we're talking thousands and thousands of acres of land. And like I said, it's around the Bob Marshall Wilderness, which is an incubator for wildlife.
So step number one then would be to have a lot of land.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And these are large livestock producers. The Mannix Ranch is there, and they do a good job trying to live with these critters. But my point is that they communicate amongst each other. They have text messaging chains where if you know Joe has a wolf on his property or a grizzly bear, and it's heading southwest, well, he knows his neighbors over there. He'll put it into the text. And it's fired over there that, you know, this bear seems to be coming your way, or this wolf is coming your way. They use fladry. They use turbo fladry, which helps, you know, is a good tool in the toolbox to keep wolves away.
What is it again?
Fladry. It's a thin nylon rope that could be miles long. It has a little red flag. Plastic flag that hangs from it, probably 10, 12 inches long, about 2 inches wide, and it flutters in the wind. And for some reason, wolves are temporarily, and when I say temporary, I mean a couple of days, nervous of this, and they won't pass that flag. And then they have turbofladry, which has an electric coordinate, so if an animal touches it, it pushes the animal away, it gives them a shock. They have, lights that they use, they have sound mechanisms that they use, and probably most important is they cleaned up their boneyards, which are when a cattle die, they used to put them in one area on each ranch. Well, what they've done now is they've arranged to have these animals picked up, moved to another location, and decomposed with using wood chips and some other methods, mm-hmm. water. And these animals break down, so that attractant that would normally pull predators to that area is no longer there. So we can do this. We just have to want to do it.
So that, you know, these Mark, these things, these measures being taken, sound like pretty much the same measures that a vineyard would take to keep birds out of the vineyard.
Sure, sure.
And
we can do this. It's just
and it actually does work. Then, so
oh, absolutely. And I encourage all your guests to check out the Blackfoot Challenge.
It's called the Blackfoot Challenge after the Blackfoot Indians
tribes. Yes, the American Indians. Yes.
Hmm. And of course, the Blackfoot Indians had to live with wolves too, because and share them with the buffalo herds. Correct.
Sure, they were hunting partners.
In what respect?
Well, they would, you know, they would, they're chasing the same prey.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's advantageous for the wolf to work with the tribes, the American Indians in the past, to locate these animals. And when they locate them, of course, the American Indians are going to push them off jumps, or kill them with spears and arrows, whatever they were using at the time. And then they leave behind gut piles. These gut piles are great nutrients for large carnivores.
So it was a win-win all the way around while it lasted.
Oh, yeah. Everybody won in that situation, the carrion, the birds. They put it on the gut piles, too.
Yeah, so the first criterion, then, for having a suitable program that would work to have wolves and domesticated livestock in the same areas, have a lot of area, a lot of land.
Yeah, absolutely.
What happens?
Habitat is everything.
Yeah. What happens when you don't have a lot of land? What can you do then?
There's options. You can use electric fence. I think the big thing is communication. I know if someone was to call Dr. Wilson and say, from the Blackfoot Challenge, and say, "Hey, Seth, what do you recommend I do?" They have pamphlets prepared that they can send out. You can reach out to us, and we work with the livestock producers and try to help them cover some of the cost of setting up fladry and other preventive measures. It can be done. We just got to want to do it.
And you have to have the wherewithal to be able to do it, because I'm just thinking about if I were a rancher and my livestock are being killed and eaten by wolves, I'm not sure I would be in the mood to send away for a pamphlet.
Well, see, that's the thing. It's easy. If you think, okay, traditionally people take care of problems here by shoot, shove, and shut up. Regardless if it's legal or illegal, they don't care. It costs a dollar for a bullet, and their problem goes away. But it really doesn't go away, because that void that you're making when you kill that animal is going to be filled by another animal. And don't be so sure of what you got, what's coming down the pipe. It might be a more aggressive animal. It may not be a more aggressive animal. But the key to this whole thing is people are out here willing to help with funding and, you know, technical expertise. You just got to tap into that. Get past the frustration of it. We understand that. But under the Endangered Species Act, these animals need to be here. So do we want to lose state management of these wildlife because all you want to do is kill them?
Yep, there's the point. If you don't play ball, then you're going to be facing the feds. And who knows what? Maybe FBI shows up in your yard.
That's been known to happen.
And then you're in really big trouble. So play balls. Well, let's look and talk about the measures that are being taken to pay for these animals that have been killed and eaten by predators. And Montana has a fund. Do other states have funds as well?
Yes. Every state has a compensation fund. And it's a good thing. It comes out of the general funds from the state, every year it's, and we've encouraged this and promoted this and always in support of it, we encourage more funding come out of the general fund to help these livestock producers who want to live with wildlife.
Okay. So then it does come out of the general fund would mean that it's taxpayers who are paying the way for this justification of two different worlds then.
Right.
How do you
it
sell?
Sure
okay. Then who is selling the taxpayers on paying the bill for this? Is that you?
Yeah. We'll help promote that. I mean, it's done legislatively. But keep in mind, you know, we're not talking, you know, millions of dollars.
Yeah.
We're talking in Montana maybe $200,000-$300,000 per year. That's not a lot of money in the scheme of things. And it's like you got to remember, okay, this year we lost 49 cattle. Last year we lost 60. 2019 we lost 57 cattle. Yes, they are losses, but they're being compensated for.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of Montanans that don't hunt and don't trap want wolves on the landscape. They want grizzly bears on the landscape. And they're willing to put their money where their mouth is. But you have a Fish, Wildlife, and Parks leadership doesn't want our money. So it's kind of a conundrum. We can't figure out what to do next. But the average Montanan doesn't mind having wolves on the ground.
Well, if you go into the Lamar River Valley of Yellowstone Park, you'll see them parked beside the highway with their spotting scope. So there's a lot of people who love seeing the wolves, no doubt about it. But you still have to contend here because there are two different sides in this incredible conflict of worlds, the world of the wild and the world of the domesticated. And so what is your messaging? What do you say, Mark, as the president of the Wolves of the Rockies? What do you tell the taxpayers on why, you know, they should put the money down to support the existence of wolves?
You know, I would have to say the only people that are opposed to any funding, general fund funding for the livestock prevention or livestock loss, the only opponents would be the individuals, the hunting community, the trophy hunting community especially, would because they don't want wolves there. There's always an ulterior motive. But I have to say, I think the average Montanan who is consumptive but not a trophy hunter, they don't mind wolves on the ground here. They actually think it's pretty unique and it's pretty cool and it's a great opportunity for tourism. It brings a lot of tourism to Montana.
And why wouldn't the hunting community, the guides and whatnot, want wolves?
Well, okay, wolves, for the most part, they prefer their natural game, which whether it be whitetail, deer, mule deer.
I don't know. If I was a wolf, I think I'd want some grain-fed beef myself.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have photos of wolf packs going through herds of domestic cattle, and they prefer not to eat them.
Huh.
They prefer the elk. But you got to understand, the trophy hunting community,
which is big business in Montana.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's running the show right now on all the anti-wolf behavior and bills that have been passed lately. The Montana Outfitters and Guides Association was a big promoter of all the anti-wolf bills. But you're right, it is big money, but the bottom line is wildlife belongs to all Montanans. National forest belongs to all Americans. We should all have say on how these animals are managed. And currently with Montana Fish, Wildlife and Parks, from the top down to the senior leadership, including the director, they're anti-wolf. They are doing nothing but mismanaging wildlife, and we're heading towards relisting. And when that happens, what people forget is when wolves are relisted, eventually they'll probably be delisted again, but there's a five-year overview where the Fed steps in and says, you're going to manage these animals properly, and we're going to watch you. So if they lose, and we're pushing hard for this, Michael, we're pushing hard at, let me just give you the organization. It's called relistwolves.org. We're pushing hard to get wolves relisted because we're going to lose them. We've already lost around 80 or 90 wolves this year so far that we know of. We also have poaching. We also have Wildlife Service control actions. So the number that you're looking at is always more, but the department, the senior leadership in the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks doesn't want people to know this.
So it's always a conflict, always has been a conflict since way back there in 1995, and will likely be a conflict, but hopefully people like Mark Cook from the Wolves of the Yellowstone and the folks at the Montana Cattlemen's Association can figure out how to just get along, as Rodney King once said. This has been the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Mark Cook, President, Wolves of the Rockies. Wolvesoftherockies.org, Mark?
Yes, and Mike, I'd appreciate it if you would mention relistwolves.org.
You just did.
People can go to.
You just did.
Yep, people can go there and sign up.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Mark. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. Mike, you have a good day.
You too.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.